Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. You won't believe what we're about to talk about. Exactly how many do you think, 40%, 20% of pets that you think in America are overweight or obese? We'll find out what those numbers are in a moment and what that means for your pets. We're talking with Dr. Ernie Ward, who is the founder and president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. Dr. Ward, good morning.
Gosh, thank you so much, Steve. And again, thank you for doing all you do to help pet parents out there navigate and understand how to take better care of their pets. And you just are an icon, and we can't thank you enough on behalf of all the veterinarians in the country.
Well, that's a bit much, but thank you very much.
Well deserved.
And all those pets in the country are, well, how many are overweight or obese? Hold on. Don't tell us yet. I want people to think in their heads what that number might be. While you're thinking, tell us about the non-for-profit that you founded called the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention.
Yeah, and I might as well also at the top mention that you are one of our esteemed board members, and I can't thank you enough for all of your efforts, and you do a lot of hard work behind the scenes to help us get the message out about the dangers and consequences of pet obesity. But we founded the organization back in 2005, and basically it was brought about because veterinarians like myself, I had about five different people in universities and in research and in different settings around the country, we were all concerned about the prevalence. We didn't have good numbers, and so we said, what if we began conducting nationwide prevalence surveys? And so we began in 2006. The following year, we got our methodology down. We did a pilot study, and then we were off to the races. So we've been tracking this for quite some time. And I do want to get back to that number because we also have, in addition to the prevalence surveys, pet parents until the end of the year, we also offer an opinion survey. In fact, we ask them that exact question, Steve, of, you know, is pet obesity a problem? How many pets do you think are affected? Dogs, cats, horses, and so forth. And it's really fascinating to look at those numbers. Of course, we ask veterinarians the same question, and, you know, sometimes those numbers don't match up.
Okay, so when I speak at veterinary meetings, I offer, and you'll reveal what the numbers are in a moment, and I'd like a comparison as to what the numbers were when you first began your organization. But I say what the numbers are, and I'm speaking with your colleagues, veterinary professionals, also veterinary including technicians. And I don't think there's a meeting I've been at where people argue with me and say, oh, no, in reality, I think those numbers are even higher. And I think people may be shocked at what that number is today. So how many dogs, how many cats are overweight or obese?
Right. And we do these prevalence surveys now every other year. So the last data that we're quoting was from 2022. And that's why if you're listening today and you're a veterinary technician, a practice manager, if you work in a vet clinic, we want you to participate because we need that data. But in 2022, all across the country, 59% of dogs and 61% of cats were classified as overweight or had obesity by their veterinarian. That's a staggering number. Now, you ask about how does that look historically? Well, when we go back and we look at some of the earliest data that we were doing, we saw that dogs and cats were down in the low 50%. So we've seen a gradual increase over the last 15 or 20 years. Now, that kind of matches up almost perfectly, or perhaps too coincidentally, with human adult obesity and overweight rates in the United States. So it's a multifactorial problem. People just quickly want to blame the food and the treats and the exercise. But, you know, Steve, it's so much more complicated. We've got genetics involved with that. We have early spay neuter involved with that, which you and I have talked about before on your radio show. We've got all kinds of environmental pollutants, including plastics, microplastics like BPA. I mean, there's a lot of factors that are really all coming together to make this sort of perfect storm of obesity.
All right. I want to unpack that. Since you've gone there, let's talk about it. An explanation for why so many pets are overweight or obese. Actually, before we do that, Dr. Ward, how do veterinarians define, because we've got such a variety.
Right.
So on the cat side, you have everything from cats that tend to be smaller cats. I mean, they're just smaller cats. They're born that way. Or specific pedigree cats like Devon Rex cats that are just little cats. On the other, you've got, on the pedigree side, Maine Coon cats or Siberian cats that are bigger cats. And even domestic short hair or domestic long hair cats vary. But in the dog side, you've got more variants than any other species on the planet. I say, I don't know if you know any Martians, but if you do, and someone landed from Mars, if they have Martians, on our planet and looked at, I don't know, antelope, they'd be able to tell that a topi antelope and a gazelle, both types of antelopes, were in fact the same species. I don't know that people could say that an Akita, a Chihuahua, and a Great Dane look like the same species. Of course, they're all dogs. We know that, but they vary so much. So because they vary so much, how do veterinarians distinguish if they're overweight or obese?
Yeah, great question, and one that we struggle with. And let's first of all take dogs, for example, because I think that's a good place to start. If you look across the spectrum of breeds, and we're talking about purebred Chihuahuas all the way up to, you know, Great Danes, Mastiffs, and so forth, and all the mixed mongrels in between, there's about a 40-fold spread in body size, body mass. So from the very smallest breed to the very largest, 40 times. This is massive. In fact, it's arguably unparalleled anywhere in the mammalian kingdom on the planet. So, you know, you really have to dig deep to try to find some rare, you know, exception. So dogs, we've bred them for utility and for traits that we admire or respect or want out of that dog. And so that's why we have these wide variations. Now, cats, on the other hand, very different. We haven't bred them for utility. We don't have working cats out there, you know? And so when you look at worldwide, the vast majority, over 95%, are these sort of mixed breeds. Now, we in our country call them domestic short hair, medium hair, long hair, but we call them domestic because the vast majority of genetics are confined to that pool. Now, you mentioned some outliers, Devon Rexes, and on the other side of the scale, we'd have Maine Coons, the largest and the smallest, so to speak. And when we look at those, they are such a small percentage. And their genetics are not commingled. So again, lots and lots of great study. Ellen Raffin over in the UK, who's a lovely, lovely researcher, has been doing this kind of work. You know, we just don't see the disparity amongst the cat genome that we see in the dog because, again, of breeding. So when we look at that data and we say, you know, well, what does a normal dog or cat look like? Well, we first of all have to say, well, it really depends for dogs, right? We got so many mixes and mongrels and purebreeds. And so you really have to look at the breed to sort of get some insight into the genetics. But when it comes to cats, we have very clear evidence that the majority of cats out there have a pretty narrow spectrum of size. And these are the domestic cats, again, that are going to be the 95% of what we see in veterinary practice and what you have in your home. And so when you look at those cats are going to be somewhere between 9 and 12 pounds. In fact, we can even go further with some of the thousands of data points that we've collected over the years. We actually can tell you what the skeleton should look like, right? So what is the axial skeleton? Like, how big should the body be from the base of the skull to the base of the tail, right? So the big bulk of the body. And that's important in cats because of all the mammals, Steve, they are arguably the most musculoskeletal efficient creature ever. I mean, they are remarkable. This is why cheetahs can propel themselves over 60 miles per hour, you know, and do amazing leaps and climb and just do incredible feats of physical prowess. And so when we look at that, we go, wait, where's all the body mass? It's in that trunk. It's in that, you know, the body that we would see. So we have very clear insights into how much those cats should weigh. So again, if you're out there today and you're saying, well, I have a very large cat, I'm going to do some measurements, right? Because there are very few Shaquille O'Neals and LeBron James in this world, right? And there are some. And so you may have a domestic short hair that somehow inherited some genes that caused it to grow very large. But, you know, most of those cats out there, 9 to 12 pounds is kind of that normal
spread. All right. I'm going to stop you there because we have to take a break. But I want to talk about dogs as well and body mass index, what that means, how it's measured, how you might be able to measure your pet at home because, well, we don't think about weight the same way as we did some number of years ago. We'll explain all of that when we come back with Dr. Ernie Ward on WGN. Dr. Ernie Ward is the founder and the president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. And in fact, this month is World Pet Obesity Awareness Month, or at least October was. We just kind of slid by that, and we should be paying attention, I think, all months of the year, but it allowed you, I presume, Dr. Ward, to say, okay, let's focus on that. Let's get some media attention. But it also is that you're conducting a survey of both pet parents and veterinary professionals.
That's right. Until, you know, from October until December 31st, 2024, we have two surveys going on. One is a veterinary clinic prevalence survey where we ask veterinarians to record the body condition scores, weights, breeds of the dogs and cats and horses that they see in their clinics or during their day-to-day practice. And then we have an opinion survey on pet food and exercise and obesity and all those kind of cool things. These are brief surveys, but they give us tremendous insight into what pet parents are thinking. So if you want to have your voice heard out there, and trust me, these pet companies listen to this survey, definitely go over to petobesityprevention.org and just take 5 minutes to fill out this survey.
All right. Now, and I hope people do that for all the reasons you mentioned. But the very basic question is, how can you tell if your dog or cat is overweight? So we talked about cats a bit. Dogs are, as we both spoke about, there are so many kinds of dogs, and they vary more as a species, our domestic dogs, than any other on the planet. That's actually true. So how can you tell if the Great Dane compared to the Chihuahua, two extremes, I know, may be overweight or obese?
Yeah, great question, and not a simple answer. What we're really focused on, if you're looking at your dog or cat today, or horse, you're focusing on the body composition. That is, how much lean muscle mass does my dog or cat have? Or myself? What about muscle? Fat mass? Do we have a pendulous abdomen? You know, a spare tire, so to speak? You know, all those kinds of things actually impact the physiology. And so what we're most concerned about with obesity is excess fat, specifically abdominal fat, because that's the most biologically active. You have, in short terms, you have two basic forms of fat in your body. One is white fat, which is the normal adipose tissue that you see. And so if you eat steak or whatever, you're seeing that marbling, that's white adipose tissue. And then there's brown fat, which is typically deposited for most mammals along the spine. And that's what bears use to store energy for hibernation, for example. And so these are physiologically, metabolically, completely different tissues. And so for most of us, the problem is going to be that white adipose tissue, that abdominal fat. And so when you're looking at your dog or cat from the side, you really want to know two things. Number one, does their abdomen tuck up? Does it have an upward slope to it? Or does it hang down? We used to call them Swiffer cats, right? But they have this like sort of belly that's protruding. And then if you look at your dog or cat from above, do they have any sort of hourglass waistline, right? Do you see a little indentation right around the hips? If you don't, again, that tells us that they're storing excess fat. So your vet's going to do something called a body condition score. Again, it's subjective, so it has its limitations, but that taken in combination with the weight, the body mass, as well as the breed predispositions, and we have already mentioned cats, we're kind of already going to slot them into that 9 to 12 pounds, but now we're going to look at their body composition. That's how we arrive at, are they overweight or do they have obesity? But Steve, it's really even more complicated. And one of the things that myself and researchers around the world are doing is we're actually trying to define something known as clinical obesity. And that's actually when active disease state is present. And we're really following our human counterparts. The Lancet Commission from the UK did this about 2 years ago. But we're actually trying to clinically define obesity as a specific disease entity. And so you may start to hear that term out there, both in human bariatric or obesity medicine, as well as veterinary.
Well, is it? Does all of this matter for our pets? And I guess the common sense answer would be, of course, but let's be more specific about it. Let's talk about how it does matter, how this actually makes a difference for your pets and a difference you might not be aware of.
Right. And, you know, this is something that we really have struggled with. And you know, one of the reasons that you form organizations like the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention and the World Pet Obesity Association is because you want to collect different thoughts, opinions, and perspectives from around the world. And one of our earlier board members, Dr. Alex German from the University of Liverpool in the UK, you know, we were struggling with this. It's like, okay, so what, right? So the dog or cat has obesity. So what? They live shorter lives, but aren't they happy? I mean, you hear people talk about fat and happy. Well, Alex set out several years ago to look at a quality of life table. And so he took people who had dogs with obesity, and he said, let's track these guys for the next year or so, and let's have them measure the quality of life. And then let's take another cohort of healthy weight dogs, dogs with a healthy body composition, and let's track them and see what the difference was. And Steve, no surprise, but the validation was powerful. The dogs with obesity all had very poor quality of life as assessed by their pet parents. Now, that was really powerful information for us because we now had a validated study done on people comparing that my dog is at a healthy body composition, my dog is not, and we found that quality of life was the big difference. And so for us, we said, okay, what would it take if you lost weight, if you could lose some of that harmful body fat to actually improve quality of life? And here is the great news. When Alex took that same group and said, okay, guys, please work with me. Let me help you get your dog down to a healthier body composition. As soon as they got to 6% loss of body weight, again, primarily body fat based on this, they were using therapeutic diets and really doing this right, quality of life improved, Steve. And that is so... That should give you hope. It's not like you have to lose all of the weight, whether it's a person or, and these studies actually have been replicated on humans as well, Steve. You don't have to lose all the weight, but you have to lose some of it, and you'll start to see the impacts.
Well, and dogs being dogs, born a dog, they all like to do certain things. And right. If they're limited by their weight, by what they can do, and we shouldn't leave cats out of this either. Cats all have a prey drive, even indoor cats. But if they can't chase and pounce because they physically are unable to do so, right. Well, then I can't imagine that they're, quote, happy cats. Clearly, they're well-fed, and maybe, if you're lucky, they're using their litter box, and they may certainly love you and you love them, but it doesn't mean that they are doing everything cats are kind of born to do. But there's more than that, and I want to talk about the likelihood of diabetes in cats and right. Cancers in dogs and cats and kidney disease in cats and all of these other medical issues that are real impacting quality of life as well. And we'll do that when we come back with Dr. Ernie Ward on WGN. This is exciting news. The San Diego Zoo Safari Park announced its first ever aardvark calf born at their facility. Woo-hoo! And this animal was born some time ago, but they wanted to make sure that mom was being a good mom before they announced it publicly. And mom turns out to be a great mom. Aardvarks are native to sub-Saharan Africa. They're nocturnal animals. They can eat up to 50,000 insects in a single evening with their tongue that's 12 inches long. So I looked it up. What are some other tongues that are really long? Well, giraffes, 18 to 20 inches. An okapi, the only relative of the giraffe, also about 18 to 20 inches. The giant anteater, 13 to 20 inches. And on average, a chameleon's tongue is twice the length of their body, which means in humans, that would be a 10 to 12 foot tongue. Ah. Dr. Ernie Ward is the founder and president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, a non-for-profit. We're talking about how many pets in America are overweight and obese? 59% of dogs and 61% of cats. That's a lot. That's more than half of the pet, millions and millions of pets. It's crazy. And we'll talk in a moment about how it got to be this way, perhaps. But let's talk about the repercussions. Are we talking about impacting not only quality of life, but also medical conditions that also impact quality of life? For example, arthritis. We now know arthritis occurs far more often than we ever thought in cats, period. And it occurs a bit more often than we ever thought in dogs. Having said that, older animals, yes, even animals that are slim and trim may well have arthritis. However, Does this exacerbate the problem, or in some cases, the pressure on those joints actually create problems, Dr. Ward?
Yeah, arthritis, diabetes, high blood pressure, cancer, I mean, respiratory disorders, the list goes on and on of the harmful consequences of obesity in dogs and cats. And even in horses, I mean, we're seeing a multitude of diseases, including crippling laminitis, which is a form of almost a form of arthritis in the hoof. And many of those horses have to be euthanized. I mean, this is devastating stuff. When we look at, you know, what percentage get this? This is where we don't have great data. And a lot of good folks around the world are working on this. But if you have a cat with obesity, you know, it's one of those situations where, remember, cats, Steve, are not born with diabetes. This is an acquired disease, and it's acquired by actually insulin resistance and damage to the pancreatic beta cells primarily, okay? So we actually cause this, and you'll hear people like me say, diabetes in cats is a food-borne disease, right? And we're saying that as a joke, but to our veterinary audiences, we're trying to say, you know, guys, don't forget, this is a consequence of obesity. And so of all the things that you can do out there, if you can keep your pet at a lean, healthy weight, the body condition with the lean muscle mass greater than the adipose tissue, the fat tissue, then they're going to live longer. They're going to enjoy life. And, you know, it's interesting, Steve, in the earlier segment, you mentioned about, you know, gosh, prey driving cats. Can you imagine, you know, if they can't do the normal things? Same for dogs. And I totally agree with you. Remember, dogs and cats don't live to eat like humans do, right? I mean, you know, we our entire culture is kind of based around eating and drinking and socializing, but dogs and cats aren't like that. They actually do a lot of other stuff. And when you can't do that because you're crippled from the pain of osteoarthritis, then again, quality of life deteriorates. And really, I believe this all leads to a lot of behavioral problems. And we've got some good evidence to back that up.
And those behavioral problems sometimes lead to euthanasia. So, for example, if the cat is too wide to fit into the litter box,
right,
the pet
right.
parent may not understand that that's the problem. All he or she knows is the cat is thinking outside the box. That cat may be euthanized as just one example. There are many examples with dogs as well. That dog is bored and the dog is unable to do anything because the dog is so, looks like a basketball. So yeah. That dog begins to bark and bark and bark because that's all that dog can do. That dog may be euthanized. So we're also right. talking about lifespan for that reason, as well as some of these disease states you mentioned can cause a shortened lifespan as well, Dr. Ward.
Oh, yeah, especially diabetes, osteoarthritis, cancer. I mean, hypertension is, again, one of those diseases that we forget about, but high blood pressure kills cats. And often, you know, we call this the silent killer because you don't know that your cat is suffering from it until it's too late. You know, they develop blindness. I mean, they have kidney problems. I mean, the list goes on and on. And just if you love cats like I do, Steve, and I know you do, and I know a lot of your audience are cat lovers, don't forget the link between obesity and kidney disease. This goes back decades in dogs and cats. So, you know, this, in fact, even in my first book, in 2008, I wrote a book called Chow Hounds about the pet obesity epidemic in the United States. And I had an entire section on kidney disease. I remember vets coming up to me after that book was published and saying, I had no idea. You know, and the research, a lot of this research was done in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And, you know, it's, we forget the relationship. And this is why you're hearing us at the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention talk about treating obesity first. In fact, you know, one of my latest articles for our newsletter, which you guys can sign up and get that every month, was all about the push for treating obesity first in human medicine. And this is what we're seeing now with all these amazing drugs that are coming out to help people with obesity. And they're finding that, wow, if we treat the obesity, the blood pressure gets better. If we're treating obesity, the arthritis pain goes away. If we're treating obesity, a lot of the GI problems resolve. I mean, you know, so Steve, it just goes on and on. Once we get obesity under control, the health, the well-being just improve.
So yes or no question, our pets are living longer than ever before right now for a variety of different reasons. They are. Would our pets live even longer than what we're seeing today if we did not have so many overweight or obese pets?
Absolutely. No question whatsoever. Because when you look at why our dogs and cats are dying, you know, a lot of these are avoidable conditions. Now, you know, we're talking a lot about, at least in veterinary medicine, about cancer, especially in dogs. And there's a big golden retriever lifetime study that's going on. And remember, too, that a lot of these cancers that we're talking about, especially in that golden retriever study, are genetic-based, right? So there's very little we can do. But here's the thing. So many of these other cancers we can avoid just by avoiding certain lifestyle, you know, issues. So we can feed them a certain way. We can exercise them a certain way. And if we can avoid obesity, then of course we then improve their quality of life across many, many different spectra. So, you know, if you ask me what, you know, there's in 2015, I started something called Project 25. And I believe
you too
firmly that I know I laugh because it's like I was a little ahead of some other folks. But regardless, my goal is to get dogs and cats to live an average 25 years. I believe that is well within the current evidence of physiology. I don't think that I think it's a bold, audacious goal, but you know, we should be able to do that, Steve. Like, I believe that the cats that we love and share our lives with, we should be shooting for 20s, not for teens.
The newsletter you mentioned is absolutely free. Tell us how people can get that.
It is. You just go to petobesityprevention.org. In fact, if you just Google pet obesity, you're going to go to our website and there's a newsletter sign up. And while you're there, take 5 minutes, fill out that prevalence survey, fill out that opinion survey. I mean, that makes all the difference. That data is used to affect, you know, how pet food manufacturers make foods and how drug companies, what they do research on. I mean, and what universities even teach. It's fascinating. I was at a university lecturing not too long ago, Steve, and one of the department heads came up and said, you know, I got to tell you, groups like yours talking about obesity have changed our curriculum. And that gives me more joy than you can imagine.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I can't think of a greater compliment, but you certainly have made a huge difference. So when we come back, I want to talk about Ozempic for pets. Is there going to be such a thing? And why it is that our pets are so overweight or obese in the first place? It's more than just you giving those pets table snacks. We'll explain with Dr. Ernie Ward when we come back on WGN. Dr. Ernie Ward is the founder and president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. Okay, Dr. Ward, I know you wrote a story about this, and I don't know if it's something I'm saying, hooray, or I'm running in the other direction because I don't know if this is good or bad. Are there going to be Ozempic-like drugs for pets for weight loss?
Steve, they're already being researched right now, and it is good news. Because remember, obesity is a disease. And when people try to make it like a lifestyle, I kind of like going, did you choose to have cancer? Like, did you decide that one day I'm just going to live an unhealthy lifestyle and I'm going to do whatever? And certainly there are consequences. And if you're a smoker, I mean, obviously lung cancer, throat cancer, and so forth can be a direct consequence. But for most of the pets that we're talking about, this is no fault of their own. And so, you know, a lot of people vilify the food and the treats and the exercise. And rightfully so, right? Because that is a big part of the problem. But we're really looking at dogs and cats that have active disease. And this is why we're using that term clinical obesity now. You're going to hear that more and more, especially in the human field. And that's when a dog or cat actually has demonstrable evidence of a disease state. So not just that they have extra fat tissue, but it's actually causing a direct consequence, a harm to their health and well-being. And that's where these drugs really come into play. And quite frankly, the reason that they're struggling with this definition and why they've carved out this new term, clinical obesity, in the human realm is because they have been struggling with this. They're saying, look, these drugs are not meant to help you get into a bikini, right? I mean, and a lot of folks are using it that way. They're actually meant to help people with diabetes, with hypertension, with all host of diseases. Now, what's happening on the vet side right now is there are at least two companies that are publicly announcing that they're beginning some R&D, and most of these are involving cats. And that should make a lot of sense to you, Steve, because you know diabetes and obesity go hand in hand. That's a consequence of obesity is diabetes. So they're saying, look, these GLP drugs, that pathway definitely helps with blood sugar. And so what about in cats? And so they're getting very creative. Now, what's also happening quietly is other folks are looking at this in dogs and so forth. And so you know, people are always asking me, when will this happen? Well, the FDA is a complex process, but I would say within 10 years, absolute certainty. Within 5 years, I'm still pretty bullish. So this stuff's going to happen. And what we hope will happen is if your dog or cat, let's say you have a 110-pound Labrador Retriever who has poor quality of life, they're on the brink of breaking down something, kidney, high blood pressure, osteoarthritis, respiratory, you name it, right? We want to intervene then. We want to save that dog's life and extend its longevity and quality of life. And that's where these drugs, I think, have real promise. And we're just going to see. And again, you know, people are often, you know, asking me too about, well, what about this and that, about the side effect or this, that, or whatever. These are the first generation. You know, I mean, this is what you're seeing in the marketplace right now is just the tip of the iceberg. I can already tell you the research that's being conducted on the second generation GLPs, much better pathways, much more specific and precise, and much fewer side effects. So, you know, Steve, I'm incredibly optimistic because this is a disease. And right now, the only treatment I have is feed less, exercise more. And how's that working for us?
Well, yeah, and that's been the recommendation for a long time. However, there are some people that still simply give too many treats to pets, either sure. table food and or manufactured dog or cat treats. So I want to talk about that. Is that at least still, because that's what I learned. I learned that's the only thing years ago. Well, I'll talk about the other things because that is not the only thing. Dr. Ward, is that still a thing?
It's still a thing. Of course it is. I mean, that's a lifestyle choice and we can make better choices, but it's not the only thing. And in fact, really, it's a culmination of the things that actually causes clinical obesity. So now you have a dog that we've bred genetically has a predisposition for high food drive. And we've identified this genetic marker for now, what, 10, 15 years, the POMC genetic marker. And so now this dog has a very high food drive that we've genetically bred that dog because that makes it more trainable. The higher the food drive, the easier it is to train because you can use food to teach it to do whatever you want it to do. That's why we got there in the first place. Well, now you say genetics play. We also have genes that are going to be with carbohydrate metabolism to make it more efficient because, again, this is a dog that's we've completely shifted their diet over, you know, the last 50,000 years. And so we're saying, okay, look, there's genetics plus overfeeding that really are adding up to this. And then I would say we have to go a step further before we would even consider using a drug. And that would be, is there clinical obesity present? That means an active disease state. So now we have evidence of kidney disease, liver harm, right? We have a problem with blood pressure. We have demonstrable osteoarthritis. I mean, that's when these drugs are really going to become impactful. So yes, feeding, exercise, incredibly important, but not just to maintain the weight, but to improve body condition, composition, and for behavioral aspects.
In this country, we spay neuter very aggressively, yeah. And there are reasons for that. Does this potentially, well, let me rephrase that. Does this, forget about potentially, does this contribute to the problem as well? I'm talking about early spay neuter.
Yeah, and you know, you and I talked about this, and I was giving you some hints about the WASAVA spay-neuter or reproductive guidelines that were coming, and they're now out. So
that's I need to interrupt. That's the World Small Veterinary Association. Go ahead.
Exactly. So I would encourage listeners, if you're interested, go to the World Small Animal Veterinary Association, WSAVA.org, and check it out. So these are guidelines that we publish for around the world. And I'm honored to serve on committee there. But, you know, we were looking at this and this was a big multi-year sort of consensus statement that had to come out. And, you know, the evidence is clear, Steve. Early spay neuter changes, again, these sex hormones have tremendous impact on muscle development, skeletal maturity, right? All those things that kind of do it. And this is why when we say if you spay or neuter your dog as a puppy or kitten, you're going to have to adjust the calories on the other side because you're going to drop their caloric requirements by 20 to 30%. There's even specially formulated diets out there now that help maintain the proper micronutrients and macronutrients, but not giving too many calories. So that's a whole nother discussion. But early spay and neuter is part of the equation here. Now, that doesn't mean that people like me and others who say this is a problem then want to tell shelters that they should stop doing what they're doing because that's for pet overpopulation. But in those situations, I don't think you have a choice, Steve. I completely support all of those efforts in the shelters.
Of course, right. And there are also medical benefits to early spay-neuter as well. Dr. Ward, before we run out of time, there is a survey that I know that pet parents yes. and also veterinary professionals can contribute to. Can you explain again?
Yes, we want your opinions on pet food and diet and exercise and obesity. And all you have to do is just a couple of minutes, go over to petobesityprevention.org. The survey is open until December 31st, 2024. If you're a vet clinic, if you're a vet tech, a vet professional out there, we want you to collect prevalence. So all you need to do is collect and record the body condition score, weight, breed of the dogs and cats and horses that you see. Again, we take those submissions all the way up to December 31st.
All right. The Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. Dr. Ernie Ward, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and I thank you very much for your passion on this topic. And you yourself, by the way, are as physically fit as anyone I know. Tell me about this thing you do in the ocean.
Oh, gosh. I'm getting old now. I'm almost 58. So I've done Ironman for many years. And then the past few years, I kind of moved over to doing more, ocean paddleboarding. And so, I like to stay active. I like to stay fit. I like to challenge myself. And the best advice I can give you if you're out there today and you're getting older like me is constantly be a newbie, so find something that you enjoy that you're not good at, you've never done before, challenge yourself. And then when you get really proficient, maybe say, let's try something else. I think that's really one of the secrets to a long and healthy life.
All right. I'll try to do radio and maybe one day I'll be proficient at it. Dr. Ernie Ward, good to talk to you always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've talked about this issue before. Retractable leashes. Those are the leashes with that big box on one end and they retract. And they're really long, generally longer than a 6-foot leash, and they're dangerous potentially. And I wrote on my website, stevedale.tv, about one woman who was blinded in one eye as a result of these. I think, I really do, that they should be banned. So let's stop making these things. Oh, well, there's other reasons too. The very concept of giving dogs room to roam, that's what they say. I mean, they can extend, depending on the leash, maybe up to 26 feet. That sounds like a good idea, but really, does the dog get that much room to run around on these things? And is it worth what happens? So you're walking a dog with a retractable leash, and the dog is actually training you because the dog is pulling you on this thing. Also, you turn a corner, what's there? You don't know what's happening. Lots of other reasons, too. Check it out on my website. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.